to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about, what are we talking about? Book 11, Chapter 9, Part 1 of The Brothers Karamazov. Then we'll be reading the second half of Chapter 9. Ivan has lost the plot and is talking to a hallucination. Discuss. Also, there was a Leo Tolstoy name drop. I Am Norwegian said, I liked the blurb on Steppenwolf, so we'll check it out. Yeah, it's very good. I recommend it. About the answer to the question, why does God allow suffering problem? I didn't find the video I was talking about. I did find this lecture, which touches upon similar things. All right, let's have a little look-see. Funnily enough, he does also finish the lecture by phrasing Dostoevsky's argument about being responsible for your beliefs in a very convincing way. He doesn't phrase Dostoevsky's ass. He talks about how we are limited, how we have to be limited to have any meaning. If we are unconstrained, we would exist everywhere at all times, and we could choose anything at once, everything at once. But we are constrained. When we choose, it's one thing over everything else. We only exist at one place, and we always move forward in time. These are the limits that give meaning to our existence. At one point, he talks about wanting to protect his son from the world and its suffering, and imagining taking out all that can lead to suffering and replacing it with something that cannot suffer. In the process, you would lose everything that makes the kid an individual worth loving. Mind and consciousness lead to suffering. A body made of flesh leads to suffering. What makes you, you leads to suffering. What makes you, you leads to suffering. If you look at God as some dude sitting in the sky directing everything that happens, then this wouldn't be very convincing. If you look at him more as something much more abstract, it does make a whole lot of sense. I remember there being more to the original argument, but I still have no idea where it came up. The title of the video is Tragedy versus Evil, and it looks like, oh, this is cool. It's Jordan Peterson, very controversial figure. But I quite like Jordan Peterson when he talks about philosophy. And this looks like an old video, 2013. So this is long before he got all mixed up in these political debates that he does. You know, the thing about Jordan Peterson is I really don't like when he talks about politics so much. And I think it's a bit of a shame that he does. I know why he does, because he gets a lot of controversy when he talks about politics, and that draws attention to his lectures on psychology and philosophy, which is really his strong suit. But he gets a bad rap because of his politics. And I don't even necessarily like have an opinion on his politics. I just don't enjoy it when he talks about them. I suppose I don't really enjoy political discourse in general. I kind of shy away in a little bit the same way as you've probably, if you've been listening for a while, you know, as soon as it starts to be like religious rants, I can sometimes like, I just don't want to hear it all again kind of feeling. But if you go back in his older lectures or his Maps of Meaning lectures, when he's not so much talking about politics, man, the guy is so interesting. So, so interesting. So, this video, Tragedy versus Evil by Jordan B. Peterson, is 42 minutes long, but you know what? I'm going to make an effort to go and watch that because I'm sure I will find it very interesting. Thank you, I Am Norwegian, for linking us to that. Techrific, you won't get me worked up like you did last time. Who is Ivan addressing here? His hallucination? Smerdyakov? Is he confusing them both? I get that he's in a haze of emotions and inner turmoil, but are we to take this at face value? Is the apparition of his guilty consciousness manifested? A demon or an angel? A demon guide, perhaps. I've read too much Hess lately. Sorry, guys. I find it funny that the apparition uses Ivan's own words against him. What's the good of believing against your will? As I've said before, Ivan is struggling with faith, not struggling with a lack of it. He believes in God, but despises him because of all the injustice and suffering in the world. It comes from a place of despair, not a lack of empathy or spirituality. He's a believer that doesn't want to believe. It's funny how his apparition comes in the guise of the old world. His attire is slightly out of fashion and worn out in places. A tired decadence. His tormentor comes to him in the clothes of his father's generation. I found this fascinating. I would say, You know, I've been saying that they've been having psychotic episodes, or at least like they seem like they're having manic episodes. Seems like now he's having a psychotic episode. I think I might have actually hit the nail on the head with the way they're ranting and talking. I don't know. Ivan definitely seems like he's having a psychotic episode now. And I should know because, not because I've had one, but because the novel that I'm writing right now, the character has a psychotic episode, stress-induced, and I've done quite a lot of research, including having conversations with lecturers, like professors and doctors of psychology who are lecturers at local universities, about psychotic episodes. A friend of mine, I'm lucky enough that a friend of mine from high school actually graduated as a doctor of psychology, and he actually lectures at RMIT, and so I'm able to meet up with him and talk psychology. And so when I say to him, hey, I want to have a character have a psychotic episode, I've done all this research, this is what my understanding is, and is this realistic, is that realistic? And I'm able to sort of cross-check everything, and I'm trying to go for a very accurate and real first-person account of a psychotic episode without being a person who's ever actually had one. And I think that's why I've been kept saying throughout this book that that's what it seems like is happening, the signs, or at least like the build-up to one. And now I would say that it seems like that's what's happening, the hallucinations caused by long paranoia, caused by chronic stress. I'm Norwegian said, I ended up thinking of Damon's too reading this chapter. I do think it's not only his guilty consciousness, but his doubt being personified as the devil. Ivan is not having anything more than a dream, but I also don't believe that matters. It's real enough, at least for Ivan. And you're right, it's starting to become really clear that God is not dead in Ivan's mind. No matter what he says, he is still a moral man that doesn't actually believe everything is permitted. He might not even actually believe that his mind is only Euclidean. The devil takes advantage of this and mocks him with the beliefs he has stated so far in the novel, and how his feelings contradict them all. The only true atheist in the book is Smurdy. Still, Ivan was attracted to Smurdy in ways he didn't understand himself. The link I share below states that this is probably Dostoevsky commenting on the attractiveness of atheism and nihilism for intellectuals. It's almost funny that it was Alyosha who had to say to Ivan that he was not actually the murderer. For the first time since we read The Grand Inquisitor, I felt compelled to Google the chapter name and stumbled onto the reification of evil and the failure of theodicy, the devil in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. I've stolen some of it for my comment here. It's quite long, but it should answer many of the questions you've asked so far, if you dive into the footnotes. Okay. I am Norwegian also said, I read the whole chapter and I will read it again tomorrow just to check out how the Garnets translated it, but also because I felt like I didn't quite grasp this chapter. There's a ridiculous number of footnotes, references to actors, characters, people, scientists, French lines, Latin lines, etc. I've definitely shared in Ivan's confusion, but I have some thoughts I will save for tomorrow. If I was a little more clever, I think this would be a very funny chapter. There does seem to be irony and jokes in there. JMama8779 said, I'm in the same boat. I think I'll go through it all again tomorrow. There is a lot in this one. Now, at this point, I read this comment earlier by I Am Norwegian and how there are many footnotes in I Am Norwegian's version of the book. And I don't think there's really any footnotes in the version I'm reading, so I asked if he might provide some of them. And he has. So what I think I'll do is I'm just going to read these before we finish the chapter, because I don't think it's going to be too spoilery. And I think as we read it, if we already know what the obscure references are, it might be better than reading it and then going back and backfilling those obscure references. So here they are. Here's the footnotes. The provincial writer tells us that the devil is 50-ish, but for some reason he does it in French. The devil donated 10 rubles to the Slavs, a reference to the Russo-Turkish War. The Russo-Turkish War. The rallying cry of the Russians was liberation from the yoke of Islam. Dostoevsky is being ironic by having the devil come down on the side of the Orthodox Christians, We've talked a little about this conflict before in relation to Dostoevsky's patriotism bordering on jingoism sometimes. In biblical cosmology, the firmament is the structure above the atmosphere of Earth, or what separates heaven and earth. This might be common knowledge, but I had never heard of the word firmament before. There is reference at the end of the chapter to Luther, who believed in the existence of the devil and would see him in the shape of a pig or flickering lights. The most famous story is that while Luther was translating the Bible, the devil came to tempt him. Luther threw the inkwell at the devil. The stain from the ink would become famous and people would pick at it until there was nothing left. A bunch of references to people you're going to forget 3 seconds into the reading. There are some footnotes letting us know that the devil slips up a bit and reveals how erudite he really is with some of his references. There is also a footnote explaining that certain non sequiturs in the chapter are intentional, that being because this is a nightmare. Okay. Thank you, by the way, I Am Norwegian, for taking the time to write up those, and I really appreciate it because, I asked you to do it as a little favour, and I don't know. I really appreciate you took the time to reply, so thank you. And I'm also writing a comment. There you go. Just in case you don't listen to the podcast, and you can see my thanks there as well. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, Dostoevsky's mentioning Tolstoy. Yes, it happens sometimes in literature. I think I read this some time ago, a Jules Verne's novel where he mentions Victor Hugo's name. The situation made me smile, but right now it evades me which book it appears, in which book appears the occurrence. I don't know much about literature, but I know there's something called Menippean satire. This is a literary genre in which frequently the characters are immersed in a kind of dream or vision. It is allegorical, humoresque, highly intellectual, and usually challenges many traditional concepts. There is a carnival-esque style in the sense that the order of things is subverted, and it makes possible the union of opposites to discuss some philosophical matters. For instance, in this novel, when Ivan, reason, and Alyosha, faith, discuss about God and morals, or in the poem The Grand Inquisitor, in which Jesus and the Inquisitor meet, and the Inquisitor offers his Machiavellian arguments. Now it dawns on me that many of Ivan's chapters are written in this style, maybe because that bestows a highly intellectual and literary aura to the character. I wonder. Mikhail Bakhtin's theory says that Menippean satire is fundamental to understand Dostoevsky's work. Laura Weistich said, I like that Ivan is demanding that the devil tells him anecdotes, but then when the devil does so, Ivan just gets more angry, probably because the anecdotes are crazy, a reflection of Ivan's mind at the moment. All right, let's continue this little trip, this little, what's the word, psychedelic hallucination that Ivan's having with the remainder of the chapter. Goes like this. You are lying. Your aim is to convince me you exist apart and are not my nightmare, and now you are asserting you are a dream. My dear fellow, I've adopted a special method today. I'll explain it to you afterwards. Stay, where did I break off? Oh yes, I caught a cold. Then, only not here, but yonder. Where is yonder, tell me? Will you be here long? Can't you go away? Ivan exclaimed, almost in despair. He ceased walking to and fro, sat down on the sofa, leaned his elbows on the table again, and held his head high in both hands. He pulled the wet towel off and flung it away in vexation. It was clearly of no use. Your nerves are out of order, observed the gentleman with a carelessly easy, though perfectly polite air. You are angry with me, even for being able to catch cold, though it happened in a most natural way. I was hurrying then to a diplomatic soiree at the house of a lady of high rank in Petersburg, who was aiming at influence in the ministry. Well, an evening suit, white tie, gloves, though I was God knows where, and had to fly through space to reach your earth. Of course, it took only an instant, but you know a ray of light from the sun takes a full 8 minutes. And fancy, in an evening suit and open waistcoat. Spirits don't freeze, but when one's in fleshy form, well, in brief, I don't think, and set off. And you know, in those ethereal spaces, in the water that is above the firmament, there's such a frost. At least one can't call it frost. You fancy 150 degrees below zero. You know the game in the village girls play. They invite the unwary to lick an axe in 30 degrees of frost. The tongue instantly freezes to it, and the dupe tears the skin off so it bleeds. But that's only in 30 degrees. In 150 degrees, I imagine it would be enough to put your finger on the axe and it would be the end of it. If only there could be an axe there. And can there be an axe there? Ivan interrupted. Carelessly and disdainfully, he was exerting himself to the utmost not to believe in the delusion and not to sink into complete insanity. An axe? The guest interrupted in surprise. Yes, that would become... What would become an axe there? Ivan cried suddenly with a sort of savage and insistent, obedient obstinacy. What would become of an axe in space? Quel idée. If it were to fall to any distance, it would begin, I think, flying around the Earth without knowing why, like a satellite. The astronomers would calculate the rising and the setting of the axe. Gatzuk would put it in his calendar. That's all. You are stupid, awfully stupid, said Ivan, peevishly. Fib more cleverly or I won't listen. You want to get the better of me by realism to convince me that you exist, but I don't want to believe you exist. I want to believe it. But I am not fibbing. It's all the truth. The truth is unhappy, hardly ever amusing. I see you persist in expecting something big of me, and perhaps something unfine. That's a great pity, for I only give what I can. Don't talk philosophy, you ass. Philosophy, indeed. When all my right side is numb, and I am moaning and groaning, I've tried all the medical faculty. They can diagnose beautifully. They have the whole of your disease at their fingertips, but they've no idea how to cure you. There was an enthusiastic little student here. You may die, said he, but you will know perfectly what disease you are dying of. And then, what a way they have of sending people to the specialists. We only diagnose, they say, but go to such and such specialist, he'll cure you. The old doctor who used to cure all sorts of diseases has completely disappeared. I assure you, now there are only specialists, and they all advertise in the newspapers. If anything is wrong with your nose, they send you to Paris. There, they say, is a European specialist who cures noses. If you go to Paris, he'll look at your nose. I can only cure your right nostril, he'll tell you, for I don't cure left nostrils. That's not my specialty. But go to Vienna. There's a specialist who will cure your left nostril. What are you to do? I fell back on popular remedies. A German doctor advised me to rub myself with honey and salt in the bathhouse. Solely to get an extra bath, I went smeared myself all over it, and it did me no good at all. In despair, I wrote to Count Mattei in Milan. He sent me a book and some drops, bless him, and only fancy, Hoff's malt extract cured me. I bought it by accident, drank a bottle and half of it, and I was ready to dance. It took it away completely. I made up my mind to write to the papers to thank him. I was prompted by a feeling of gratitude, and only fancy, it led to no end of a bother. Not a single paper would take my letter. It would be very reactionary, they said. None will believe it. Le disable d'exist point. The devil does not exist. You'd better remain anonymous, they advised me. What use is a letter of thanks if it's anonymous? I laughed with the men at the newspaper office. It's reactionary to believe in God in our days, I said, but I am the devil, so I may be believed in. We quite understand that, they said. Who doesn't believe in the devil? Yet it won't do. It might injure our reputation. As a joke, if you like. But I thought, as a joke, it wouldn't be very witty, so it wasn't printed, and do you know, I have felt sore about it to this day. My best feelings, gratitude, for instance, are literally denied me simply from my social position. Philosophical reflections again, Ivan snarled malignantly. God preserve me from it, but one can't help complaining sometimes. I am a slandered man. You upbraid me every moment with being stupid. One can see you are young. My dear fellow, intelligence isn't the only thing. I have naturally a kind and merry heart. I also write vaudevilles of all sorts. You seem to take me for Helitskov, grown old, but my fate is far more serious one. Before time was, by some decree which I could never make out, I was predestined to deny, and yet I am genuinely good-hearted and not at all inclined to negation. No, you must go and deny without denial. There's no criticism, and what would a journal be without a column of criticism? Without criticism, it would be nothing but one hosanna. But nothing but hosanna is not enough for life. The hosanna must be tried in the crucible of doubt, and so on, in the same style. But I don't meddle in that. I don't create it. I am not answerable for it. Well, They've chosen their scapegoat. They've made me write the column of criticism, and so life was made possible. We understand that comedy, for instance, simply ask for annihilation. No, live, I am told, for there'd be nothing with you without you. If everything in the universe was sensible, nothing would happen. There would be no events without you, and there must be events. So against the grain, I serve to produce events and do what's irrational because I command to. For all the indisputable intelligence, men take this farce as something serious, and that is their tragedy. They suffer, of course, but then they live. They live a real life, not a fantastic one, for suffering is life. Without suffering, what would be the pleasure of it? It would be transformed into an endless church service. It would be holy but tedious. But what about me? I suffer, but still I don't live. I am X in an indeterminate equation. I am a sort of phantom in life who has lost all beginning and end, and who has even forgotten his own name. You are laughing. No, you are not laughing. You are angry again. You are forever angry. All you care about is intelligence, but I repeat again that I would give away all this superstellar life, all the ranks and honours, simply to be transformed into the soul of a merchant's wife weighing 18 stone and set candles at God's shrine. Then even you don't believe in God, said Ivan, with a smile of hatred. What can I say? That is, if you are in earnest. Is there a God or not? Ivan cried with the same savage intensity. Ah, there you are in earnest, my dear fellow. Upon my word, I don't know. There, I've said it now. You don't know, but you see God. No, you are not someone apart. You are myself. You are and I. You are I and nothing more. You are rubbish. You are my fancy. Well, if you like, I have the same philosophy as you. That will be true. Je pense donc Jesus. I think, therefore I am. I know that for a fact. All the rest, all these worlds, God and even Satan, all that is not proved to my mind. Does all that exist of itself, or is it only an emanation? Excuse me. Is it only an emanation of myself? A logical development of my ego, which alone has existed forever. But I make haste to stop, for I believe you'll be jumping up to beat me directly. You'd better tell me some anecdote, said Ivan miserably. There is an anecdote precisely on our subject, or rather a legend, not an anecdote. You reproach me with your unbelief, you see. You say, yet you don't believe. But, my dear fellow, I am not the only one like that. We are all in a muddle over there now and all through your science. Once there used to be atoms, 5 senses, 4 elements, and then everything hung together somehow. There were atoms in the ancient world even, but since we've learned that you've discovered the chemical molecule and protoplasm and the devil knows what, we had to lower our crest. There's a regular muddle, and above all, superstition, scandal. There's as much scandal among us as among you. You know, a little more, in fact, and spying, indeed, for we have our secret police department, where private information is received. Well, this wild legend belongs to our Middle Ages, not yours, but ours. And no one believes it, even among us, except the old ladies of 18 stone. Not your old ladies, I mean, but ours. We've everything you have. I am revealing one of our secrets of our friendship for you. Though it's forbidden, this legend is about paradise. There was, they say, here on earth, a thinker and a philosopher. He rejected everything, laws, conscience, faith, and above all, the future life. He died. He expected to go straight to darkness and death, and he found a future life before him. He was astounded and indignant. This is against my principles, he said, and he was punished for that. That is, you must excuse me, I am just repeating what I heard. It's only a legend. He was sentenced to walk 1,000,000,000 kilometres in the dark. We've adopted the metric system, you know. And when he has finished that 1,000,000,000, the gates of heaven would be opened to him, and he'll be forgiven. And what tortures have you in the other world besides 1,000,000,000 kilometres, Ivan asked, with a strange eagerness. What tortures? Ah, don't ask. In old days we had all sorts, but now they have taken chiefly to moral punishments, the stings of conscience and all that nonsense. We got that, too, from you, from the softening of your manners. But who's the better for it? Only those who have got no conscience. For how can they be tormented by conscience when they have none? But decent people who have conscience and a sense of honour suffer from it. Reforms, when the ground has not been prepared for them, especially if they are institutions copied from abroad, do nothing but mischief. The ancient files was better. Well, this man, who was condemned to the 1,000,000,000 kilometres, stood still, looked round, and lay down across the road. I won't go, I refuse on principle. Take the soul of an enlightened Russian atheist and mix it with the soul of the prophet Jonah, who sulked for 3 days and nights in the belly of the whale, and you get the character of what that thinker who lay across the road. What did he lie on there? Well, I suppose there was something to lie on. You are not laughing. Bravo, cried Ivan, still with the same strange eagerness. Now he was listening with an unexpected curiosity. Well, is he lying there now? That's the point, that he isn't. He lay there almost 1,000 years, and then he got up and went on. What an ass, cried Ivan, laughing nervously, and still seeming to be pondering something intently. Does it make any difference whether he lies there for ever or walks a quadrillion kilometres? It would take 1 billion years to walk it. Much more than that. I haven't got a pencil and paper, or I couldn't work it out. But he got there long ago, and that's where the story begins. What, he got there? But how did he get the 1 billion years to do it? Why, you keep thinking of our present Earth, but our present Earth may have been repeated 1 billion times. Why, it's become extinct, been frozen, cracked, broken to bits, disintegrated into its elements again, the water above the firmament, that again the comet, and again the sun. Again from the sun it becomes the Earth, and the same sequence may have been repeated endlessly and exactly the same to every detail. Most unseemly and insufferably tedious. Well, well, what happened when he arrived? Why, the moment the gates of paradise were opened, and he walked in before he had been there 2 seconds by his watch, though, to my thinking, his watch must have been long dissolved into the elements of the way. He cried out that those 2 seconds were worth walking not a quadrillion kilometres, but a quadrillion of quadrillions, raised to the quadrillionth power. In fact, he sang Hosanna, and overdid it so that some persons there of lofty ideas wouldn't shake hands with him at first. He became too rapidly reactionary. They said, the Russian temperament, I repeat, it's a legend. I give it for what it's worth. So that's the sort of ideas we have on such subjects even now. I've caught you, Ivan cried, with an element almost childlike delight, as though he had succeeded in remembering something at last. That anecdote about the quadrillion years I made up myself. I was 17 then. I was at high school. I made up that anecdote and told it to a schoolfellow called Korovkin. It was at Moscow. The anecdote is so characteristic that I couldn't have taken it from anywhere. I thought I'd forgotten it, but have unconsciously recalled it. I recalled it myself, and it was you telling it, not you telling it. Thousands of things are unconsciously remembered like that, even when people are being taken to execution. It's come back to me in my dream. You are that dream. You are a dream, not a living creature. From the vehemence with which you deny my existence, laughed the gentleman, I am convinced that you believe in me. Not in the slightest, I haven't 1/100th part of a grain of faith in you. But you have 1/1000th of a grain. Homeopathic doses, perhaps, are the strongest. Confess that you have faith, even to 10,000th of a grain. Not for 1 minute, cried Ivan furiously. Not for 1 minute, cried Ivan furiously. But I should like to believe in you, he added strangely. Aha, there's an admission. But I am good-natured. I'll come to your assistance again. Listen, it was I caught you, not you, me. I told you your anecdote. You'd forgotten to on purpose so as to destroy your faith in me completely. You are lying. The object of your visit is to convince me of your existence. Just so. But hesitation, suspense, conflict between relief and disbelief, it's sometimes such torture to a conscientious man, such as you are, that it's better to hang oneself at once. Knowing that you are inclined to believe in me, administered some disbelief by telling you that anecdote. I lead you to believe and disbelieve by turns, and I have my motivation in it. It's the new method. As soon as you disbelieve in me completely, you'll begin assuring me to my face that I am not a dream, but a reality. I know you. Then I shall have attained my object, which is an honourable one. I shall sow in you only a tiny grain of faith, and it will grow into an oak tree, and such an oak tree that, sitting on it, you will long to enter the ranks of the hermits in the wilderness and the saintly women. For that is what you are secretly longing for. You'll dine on locusts, you'll wander into the wilderness to save your soul. Then it's for the salvation of my soul you are working, is it, you scoundrel? One must do a good work sometimes. How ill-humoured you are. Fool, did you ever tempt those holy men who ate locusts and prayed 17 years in the wilderness till they were overgrown with moss? My dear fellow, I've done nothing else. One forgets the whole world and all the worlds and sticks to one such saint because he is a very precious diamond. One such soul, you know, is sometimes worth a whole constellation. We have our system of reckoning, you know. The conquest is priceless, and some of them, on my word, are not inferior to you in culture, though you won't believe it. They can contemplate such depths of belief and disbelief at the same moment that sometimes it really seems that they are within a hair's breadth of being turned upside down, as the actor Gurbunov says. Well, did you get your nose pulled? My dear fellow, observed the visitor sententiously, it's been to get off with your nose pulled than better to get off with your nose pulled than without a nose at all. As an afflicted marquis observed not long ago, he must have been treated by a specialist. In confession to a spiritual father, a Jesuit, I was present. It was simply charming. Give me back my nose, he said. And he beat his breast. My son, said the priest evasively, all things are accomplished in accordance with the inscrutable decrees of Providence, and what seems a misfortune sometimes leads to extraordinary though unapparent benefits. If sternly destiny deprived you of your nose, it is your advantage that no one ever can ever pull you by your nose. Holy Father, that's no comfort, cried the despairing marquis. I'd be delighted to have my nose pulled every day of my life if it were only in its proper place. My son, sighs the priest. You can't expect every blessing at once. This is murmuring against Providence, who even in his last, in this, has not forgotten you. For if you repine as you repine just now, declaring you'd be glad to have your nose pulled for the rest of your life, your desire will already be fulfilled indirectly, for when you lost your nose, you were led by the nose. Fool, how stupid, cried Ivan. My dear friend, I only wanted to amuse you, but I swear that's the genuine gesture causuity, and I swear that it all happened word for word, as I've told you it happened lately, and gave me a great deal of trouble. The unhappy man shot himself that very night when he got home. I was by his side till the very last moment. The Jesuit confessionals are really my most delightful diversion and melancholy moments. Here's another incident that happened only the other day. A little blonde Norman. This is all a dream, by the way. So none of this is anything. None of this factors into the plot. I've just come to realize that this is just... You know when someone goes, I had the weirdest dream the other night. And you just think, okay, for the next like 30 seconds or a minute, this person's going to tell me all these things that are so weird. And they're going to insist, isn't that so weird? But the things that they are explaining literally didn't happen. So it's like it's not that weird that you just imagined something weird. And none of it has any effect on real life. And this happens to... How often does it happen that someone dives into an explanation of a dream they had and you just kind of tick down the moments until the story finishes until you can just kind of go, oh, wow, that's so weird. But even though you weren't actually listening. But that's the only... response to say at the end of someone's dream sequence that they have to explain to you. This whole chapter, this whole boring rant about nothing is boring and tedious as it is, but then once it's finished you can tie it all up and just delete it from your memory because none of it meant anything. Even it was fiction, it was inconsequential fiction within a fiction story. Anyway, here's another incident that happened only the other day. A little blonde Norman girl of 20, a buxom, unsophisticated beauty that would make your mouth water, comes to an old priest. She bends down and whispers her sin into the grating. Why, my daughter, have you fallen again already? Cried the priest. O Cantamia, what do I hear? Not the man, same man this time. How long is it going on? Aren't you ashamed? O mon père, answers the sinner with tears of penitence. Quelle other language. Ah, my father, this gives him so much pleasure and me so little pain. Fancy such an answer. I drew back. It was the cry of nature, bitter than innocence itself. If you like, I absolved her sin on the spot and was turning to go, but I was forced to turn back. I heard the priest at the grating making an appointment with her for the evening, though he was an old man, hard as flint. He fell in an instant. It was nature. The truth of nature asserted its rights. What you are turning up, you're turning up your nose again, angry again. I don't know how to please you. Leave me alone. You are beating on my brain like a haunting nightmare. Ivan moaned miserably, helpless. Before his apparition, I am bored with you agonizingly and insufferably. I would give anything to be able to shake you off. I repeat, moderate your expectations. Don't demand of me everything great and noble, and you'll see how well we shall get on. Said the gentleman impressively, you are really angry with me for not having appeared to you in a red glow with thunder and lightning, with scorched wings, but I have shown myself in much a modest form. You wounded in the first place in ascetic feelings, and second in your pride. You could see a vulgar devil visit as such a great man as you. Yes, there is a romantic strain in you that was derided by Bielinski. I can't help it, young man, as I got ready to come to you. I did think of a joke appearing in the figure of a retired general who served in the Caucasus with the Star of the Lion and the Son of Makota, but I was positively afraid of doing it, and you'd have trusted me for daring to pin the Lion on the Son of Makota, and instead of the Least and Apollo of the Star and the Sirius, and you keep saying I'm stupid and the mercy honours, and I take my claim and the equal to human intelligence, metaphysical, the goblins, force to desire the evil, blah, 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 one whole page of just bullshit. Well, he can say what he likes. I'm quite the opposite. With me, I am perhaps the one man in all creation who loves the truth and genuinely desires good. If there wasn't a word who died and the cross rose up into heaven, bearing in his bosom in the soul of the penitent thief, I heard the glad shrieks of the Cuberum singing and the shouting Hosanna and the thunderous rapture of the Seraphim and something creation. I swear you by all that's sacred, I long to join the choir and shout Hosanna with them all. The word had me almost escaped me and had almost broken from my lips. You know how susceptible and aesthetically impressionable I am, but common sense, oh, a most unhappy trait of my character, kept me from my due bounds, and I let the moment pass. For what would have happened, I reflected, what would have happened after my Hosanna? Everything on earth would have been extinguished at once, and no events could have occurred, and so, solely from a sense of duty and my social position, was forced to suppress the good moment and to stick to my nasty task. Somebody takes all the credit of what's good for himself, and nothing but nastiness is left for me, but I don't envy the honour of a life of idle imposture. I am not ambitious. Why am I, of all creatures in the world, doomed to be cursed by all decent people who have even to be kicked? For if I put on mortal form, I am bound to take such consequences sometimes. I know, of course, there's a secret in it, but they won't tell me the secret for anything, for then perhaps, seeing the meaning of it, I might bawl Hosanna, and an indispensable minus would disappear at once, and good sense would reign supreme throughout the whole world. And that, of course, would mean the end of everything, even the magazines and the newspapers, for who would take them in? I know that at the end of all things I shall be reconciled. I too shall walk my quadrillion and learn the secret, but till that happens I am sulking and fulfill my destiny, though it's against the grain. That is, that to ruin thousands for the sake of saving one, how many souls have had to be ruined, and how many honourable reputations destroyed were for the sake of that one righteous man, Job, over whom they made such a fool of me in such old days. Yes, till the secret is revealed, there are two sorts of truth in me, one their truth yonder, and there's some knowing which to turn to better. Are you asleep? Yes. I might well be, Ivan groaned angrily. All my stupid ideas outgrown, thrashed out long ago, and flung aside like a dead carcass, you present to me as something new. Wow. Talk about a summary of the whole book. Let me just repeat that line to you. And the irony that Dostoevsky couldn't see that this is exactly what his entire novel was. Are you asleep? I might well be, Ivan groaned angrily. All my stupid ideas outgrown, thrashed out long ago, and flung aside like a dead carcass, you present to me as something new. Wow. The irony of that sentence. There's no pleasing you, and I thought I should fascinate you by my literary style. That Hosanna in the Skies really wasn't bad, was it? And then that ironical tone, a la Heine, eh? No, I was never such a flunky. How then could my soul beget a flunky like you, my dear fellow? I know a most charming and attractive young Russian gentleman, a young thinker and a great lover of literature and art, and the author of a promising poem entitled The Grand Inquisitor. I was only thinking of him, and I forbid you to speak of the Grand Inquisitor, cried Ivan, crimson of shame. And the geological cataclysm, but do you remember that was a poem? Now hold your tongue, or I'll kill you. You'll kill me, no excuse, I will speak. I came to treat myself in the pleasure and dreams and the art and the young friends, quivering with eagerness of life. There are new men. You decided last spring when you were meaning to come here, those purposes to destroy everything and begin the cannibalism. Stupid fellows, they didn't ask my advice. I maintain that nothing need to be destroyed, but we only need to destroy the idea of God in man. That's how we have to set to work. It's that we must begin with, O blind race of men who have no understanding, as soon as men have all of them denied God. And I believe that period analogous with geological periods will come to pass, and the old conception of the universe will fall into itself in cannibalism, and what's more, the old morality and everything will begin new. Men will unite to take the life of all that it can give, but only for the joy of happiness. In the present world, man will be lifted up with the spirit of divine titanic pride, and the man God will appear from hour to hour, extending into consequence of nature and infinitely by his will and his science. Man will something joy lofty hour to hour is doing, and is some more something everything will know that he is mortal and will accept death proudly and serenely like a god. His pride will teach him that he is useless for him to repine at life's being a moment, and he will love his brother without need of reward. Love will be sufficient only for a moment of life, but the very consciousness of its momentariness will intensify its fire, which now is dissipated in dreams of eternal love beyond the grave, and so on in the same style, charming. Ivan sat with his eyes on the floor and his hands pressed in his ears. He began trembling all over. The voice continued. The question now is, my young thinker reflected, is it possible that such a period will ever come? If it does, everything is determined and humanity is settled forever. But as, owing to man's inveterate stupidity, this cannot come about for at least 1,000 years, everyone who recognizes the truth even now may legitimately order his life as he pleases on the new principles. In that sense, all things are lawful for him. What's more, even if this period never comes to pass, since there is anyway no God and immortality, a new man will become God. Even if even if he does, the only one in the whole world that promoted it is something in my hardness, overstepped the barriers of the old morality and the old enslavement. There is no law of God. Where God stands, the place is holy. Where I stand, we're the one's foremost place. All things were lawful, and that's the end of it. That's all charming, but if you want to swim, to why do you want a moral sanction for doing it? But that's how modern Russia all over. He can't bring himself to swindle without a moral sanction. He is so in love with truth. The visitor talked, obviously carried away by his own eloquence, speaking louder and louder and looking ironically at his host. But he did not succeed in finishing. Ivan suddenly snatched a glass from the table and flung it at the orator. But after all, that's stupid, cried the latter, jumping up from the sofa and shaking the drops of tea off himself. He remembers Luther's inkstand. He takes me for a dream and throws glasses at a dream. It's like a woman. I suspected you were only pretending to stop up your ears. A loud, persistent knocking was suddenly heard at the window. Ivan jumped up from the sofa. Do you hear? You'd better open, cried the visitor. It's your brother Alyosha with the most interesting and surprising news, I'll be bound. But be silent, deceiver. I know it is Alyosha. I felt he was coming. And of course he has not come for nothing. Of course he brings news, Ivan exclaimed frantically. Open, open to him. There's a snowstorm, and he is your brother. Monsieur say ill attempts, blah, blah, blah. Does the gentleman know the weather he's making? It's not weather for a dog. The knocking continued. Ivan wanted to rush to the window, but something seemed to fetter his arms and legs. He strained every effort to break his chains, but in a vain. The knocking at the window grew louder and louder. The chains broken, and Ivan leapt up from the sofa. He looked around him wildly, but candles had almost burnt out. The glass he had just thrown at his visitor stood before him on the table, and there was no one on the sofa opposite. The knocking on the window frame went in persistently, but was no means as loud as it seemed in a dream. On the contrary, it was quite subdued. It was not a dream. No, I swear it was not a dream. It all happened just now, cried Ivan. He rushed to the window and opened with no movable pain. Alyosha, I told you not to come, he cried fiercely at his brother. In two words, what do you want? In two words, do you hear? An hour ago, Smerdyakov hanged himself, Alyosha answered from the yard. Come round to the steps. I'll open at once, said Ivan, going to open the door to Alyosha. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you very much for listening today. I'll see ya tomorrow.